Hello to all Earth citizens and welcome to my Conscious Coaching Podcast. This is Dr. Kianush, founder and creative director of MCCG. My Conscious Coaching Group is a non-political, non-religious 501c3 coaching nonprofit with initiatives in healthcare, leadership, and education with focus on emotional and spiritual intelligence. Our vision is to raise self and global awareness for a conscious mind through education and application of EQ and SQ, and our mission is to connect, collaborate, and partner with hospitals, academics, colleges, and medical schools and organizations to embrace growth, self-healing, and self-coaching to achieve well-being and peak performance of individuals and the team as a one connected whole. Today, we have a very special guest, Dr. David Rosmarin, whom I had the opportunity to meet and learn from during my certification at World Congress on Moral Injury, Trauma, Spirituality, and Healing. And as part of her, that's the program as part of the Harvard Human Flourishing Program. Dr. David Rosmarin, PhD, is an associate professor at Harvard Medical School and director of McLean Hospital Spirituality and Mental Health Program. He innovates methods for integrating spirituality into evidence-based mental health treatments. He is also a widely cited researcher in this area who had authored over 100 peer-reviewed publications. In addition to his academic work, Dr. Rosmarin is also founder of Center for Anxiety, which services over 1,000 patients a year in multiple states. His work has been featured in Scientific American, the Boston Globe, the Wall Street Journal, and the New York Times. He is the author of the trade nonfiction book, Thriving with Anxiety, 9 Tools to Make Your Anxiety Work for You, which was released on October 2023 by HarperCollins. Dr. Rosmarin, welcome to MCCG Podcast, and thank you so much for joining us today.
Thanks very much for having me. It's a real honor to be here.
I appreciate that. I always ask my speakers, aside from their formal bio, that how do you like the world to know you as a person, or what for?
Yes. Well, I am married for nearly 25 years and have 6 kids at home. So I think that's probably the best way to characterize me as a person. Professionally, you covered a whole bunch of bases beforehand.
Yeah, and such a blessing, such a wonderful, you know, story that you have behind all of this. And just getting to our first question, Dr. Rosmarin, or if I call you David, what is, to your opinion, the definition of spirituality and how different it is from religion?
Sure. Spirituality, a very broad term. According to my graduate school mentor anyway, Dr. Ken Pergament, who's been really one of the foremost psychological scientists looking at this construct for, I don't know, 4 decades now. It's any way that human beings seek to engage with that which they perceive as sacred. When a person perceives there to be something beyond the physical world, whatever that is, however that manifests, and any way of relating to that at all, that is spirituality. Again, a very broad construct. And you mentioned religion before. Religion is a subset of spirituality, which involves culture-bound ways of relating to the sacred, defining the sacred, engaging with that which is metaphysical in some way. So if you have a group of people who are engaged in the same way with a shared perception of spirituality, that would be a religion.
I mean, as we were talking before the interview, so I had a near-death experience, and I wasn't spiritual or religious, but I believed in God, and I was raised in a religious family, but never practiced by the religion that I was born with it. And after my near-death experience, I mean, with my understanding of spirituality, religion is a teeny tiny part of the spirituality, and the spirituality is a whole broad spectrum, you know, of that, that holistic, you know, the understanding that we have from the universe, from our intelligent universe. But yeah.
Statistically speaking, in the United States, most people who have spiritual beliefs are religious. So just to be clear, it is in theory a small section, religion compared to spirituality in terms of concept, yes. But in terms of, you know, statistically, most people who, at least in the Western hemisphere, who have spiritual beliefs do draw upon culture-bound ways of engaging with the sacred, i.e. religion. But your point about near-death experiences, I mean, it's an incredible phenomenon. I'm sure you're familiar with Ibn Alexander, who was in my
department. Yes. Yeah, we had a podcast actually with him. It's in our YouTube channel if you're interested to listen to that. Yeah, I know him personally through IANS, International Association of Near Death Studies. Yeah, and just to be clear, although spirituality, and religions are override each other, but not necessarily if you are a spiritual, you have to be religious too. So just want to be clear on that.
No, of course. That goes without saying.
So I'm just curious about what brought you at first place to do the research on spirituality and mental health, and what's the story behind the initiatives? And I know your thesis was about the spirituality. Can you tell us a little bit on that?
Yeah. Why am I studying spirituality and mental health? Good question.
Yeah.
I personally am a religious faith. A faith is a big part of my life, a big part of my culture, a big part of my family. And I was really shocked when I was going into clinical psychology, simply because I wanted to study emotions and how to manage them and how to understand them and how to help people struggling with emotional and behavioral disorders. I was shocked at how little the topics of spirituality and religion were covered. I mean, the only coverage of the topic in my Psychology 101 course was about religious psychosis, people who believe that they're God or believe that they're messianic in some way.
Hmm.
And it really didn't do justice to me to the many ways that spirituality can connect to mental health. In many cases, it's a resource. Some people have their faith as something that gives them hope and meaning in times of difficulty. Sometimes it's a struggle. Sometimes people are grappling with their faith community or with things that have happened to them or wondering, why did God abandon me, or whatever it is. Either way, for positive and negative, these are the kind of things that need to be studied, understood, like any area of human identity and human diversity. And over the past, now it's 20 or close to 30 years, I've been studying this and trying to make a dent in the academy, with some wins, some losses, and some points in between.
Yeah, exactly. And you brought the emotion part. So I'm also, certified on emotional intelligence. And I believe that, spiritual intelligence and spirituality is related to emotional intelligence. And to be able to manage and translate what our emotions give us as a data, and they are kind of interconnected. What's your take on that one? So how they are related, spirituality and emotional intelligence?
Sure. Any aspect of human identity and human diversity is going to be related to emotional intelligence. When people are more mindful of culture, when people are more mindful of their background, when they're more mindful of economics, when they're more mindful of issues of sexuality, those lean in to being more emotionally focused and more able to understand, who is the person in front of me? Who am I? How do we interface with each other? How does this person's experiences shape what they're having right now in front of me? I think it makes us a more effective coach, leader, psychologist, whatever it is. When it comes to spirituality, though, somehow there's a block. It's like the topic doesn't even register when it comes to my clinical and academic colleagues.
Exactly.
Obviously, it's changed, but it's a shame. I think it's a shame, and I don't think it services our patients well, because most people who come in to a clinical setting have spirituality among other aspects of their identity that really need to be explored and delved into.
Yeah, exactly. It's just some kind of like a taboo word, especially when you come to the education. A school system, colleges, But recently I see that in the medical school, they are having courses about the spirituality and healing. George Washington University, Jewish, has this
Jewish
course for the medical school, program as well. So just as a psychiatrist, so do you believe that we as human, is it the right way to say, are soulful beings?
Do I believe we are soulful beings? Well, interestingly, the term psychology literally means study of the soul. But you find the soul almost nowhere within the field. It's a great irony, in fact. I believe that what's important is to identify when our patients are perceiving themselves and the world as soulful, and how that interfaces with their emotions. I know personally from my own experience, when I go through difficult times, resorting to faith, resorting to prayer, resorting to my community makes a huge difference. And those are resources that, frankly, if I didn't have, I probably would have very significant symptoms like many of my patients. But for other individuals, and sometimes this has happened in my own life, there are spiritual struggles where people are grappling with aspects, big questions. Who am I? What did I just do? What does this make me into? What's my purpose in this universe? Am I, you know, being punished by a malevolent being? And those are very significant. Those spiritual struggles, when people have them, they can have a massive difference on their health. So I think, yes, you know, ultimately, I believe as a person of faith that humans are soulful. But what's much more important is the interplay between my patient's beliefs and their mental health. And that's really my job.
Yeah, that's interesting how this soul factor, I mean, involved in our mental health and well-being, and how does that work? I mean, to my understanding from my near-death experience and what I'm learning from you is just that our soul and our soul work is just what is connecting us to the one truth of consciousness. It's just like a bridge or anchor or a compass, you know, to our calling and what is holding us, you know, in a difficult, stressful time, but which we are talking about the anxiety later on, you know, in this interview. And we are reaching to the good part that is about, that's your book, Thriving with Anxiety. Can you tell us a little bit about that? What does it cover? Why did you write it? And what's the message?
Sure. I'll tell you the story. During the beginning stages of the pandemic, I was very, very anxious. Who wasn't is my patients. And that's that was the amazing thing. I was terrified most of all that my patients were going to have a very hard time.
Yeah.
My clinical program, Center for Anxiety, had more than 500 patients at the time. And there are these early reports of anxiety and depression and suicidality going through the roof, right? We're shifting everything to telehealth. All of my clinical staff, all of my patients, everything out of the offices. And what's going to be, right? I was really nervous.
I know.
As anyone would be. And to my surprise, our patients who were in treatment prior to March 2020 did not have an increase in anxiety as a whole. That group did not have an increase of anxiety at any point during the pandemic.
Interesting.
Yeah, we recently published a paper on that. And in Plus One, it's an open access paper. I'm happy to send it to you. You can put it in the show notes.
Definitely. Yeah, I appreciate that, sharing that with our audience and with our community.
What was remarkable to me was that anxiety for this group of patients was actually a blessing, because since they had it before the pandemic, they got the skills that they needed, and that anxiety became a strength. It inoculated them against pandemic-related distress, and they did not experience significant anxiety during one of the most stressful periods in human history.
Very interesting. Very interesting. I mean, glimpsing through your books. I haven't finished it yet. I'm having both audible and the printed one. So, and there is part that's my favorite part. That is just how to transform anxiety to love. So can you tell us a little bit on that?
Sure. The general concept behind the book, just before we get to the specifics about love, is that we view anxiety as a disease in our society. And somehow in my spiritual training, so to speak, in delving into the subject, and through this experience of what happened pre-pandemic or during the pandemic, I've come to see it through a different lens, that anxiety is part of being human. And it's not a bad part. It's uncomfortable. It's not pleasant. But when we lean into our anxiety, we can actually become more resilient, more strong, emotionally strong, and better able to handle situations. Now, you mentioned love. So that's a specific way. And all throughout the book, the subtitle is 9 Tools to Make Your Anxiety Work for You.
Yeah.
The goal of the book is not to get rid of your anxiety. If people want to feel less anxious, don't read my book. The goal is to get anxiety to work for you in a constructive, positive way.
And what are those 9 tools? Can you just, I mean,
well,
tap
I can't
on
go
it?
Through all 9 of them.
But the most important one.
I love the love one. I think that you nailed it on the head for one of the most important ones.
Yeah.
You know, you have an amazing story. I got I have a question for you before I answer your question about turning
Definitely.
God to love. When you emerged from your near-death experience, was it a little hard for you to confide and to talk to friends, colleagues about what you'd experienced before?
Yeah, actually, I wasn't even talking to my husband for about 2 weeks about it. And because I was just, I mean, concerned that people may think I'm out of my mind, you know, but the love that I experienced and in the glimpse to afterlife was more real. I mean, and vibrant and intelligent than any other kind of experience that I had on the earth. And I didn't talk with anyone up to 2 weeks, but
2 weeks.
I was, but then I told my husband, I mean, then he started, he's a physician as well. So all the medical, you know, justification came around. My son also is the physician as well. So, and as I expected, you know, the skepticism and arose and they didn't believe me just, I mean, frankly, until and I start doing my research and find out later about the International Association of Near-Death Studies through an interview on NPR and that Barbara Bradley was talking about her new book. Actually, my husband heard it about her new book, Fingerprints of God. And he told me, you know, the story that you are telling me, she has done a research on it. Yeah. And then he believed me. And so that was interesting for me because it just was a confirmation of my own experience, which I really believed in. And it changed my life through that. And actually that love changed my life, not just the experience.
Sure. Leaning into that anxiety and actually telling your husband how you felt. That was a big risk on your part.
It was.
Yeah. And it took some time. He didn't get it right away, and understandably, given his training and where he's
from.
And now, looking back, how many years later is it?
It's my NDE was about in 2006. Okay. Yeah.
Looking back, the fact that you shared it with him and took that risk and allowed him to go through his own process of coming around, has that brought you two closer together?
Yes, it did. Yes, it did in many ways. I mean, in many ways, because it also changed my life as I was talking to you about it before. I shifted my love from, I mean, being a research pathologist to coaching. And along my education and certification in the coaching. So just, I mean, it benefited both of us. I mean, in many ways. And he's more spiritual now. I mean, maybe not that much religious, but more spiritual and open to, I mean, all kind of conversation as is my son. And as I mentioned, there's so many research on it. And I'm in a community that there are so many people that are experiencing it. But more than risking that just conversation with my husband, that wasn't a risk to me. More it was when I launched my nonprofit and I wrote my chapter book about it and going to public, you know, that was for me that a leap of faith and needed kind of courage to come out of my shell and tell the world about it, not just the family, you know, my healthcare community, my social community, and write about it, create the website and bringing it actually to my coaching practice as well as an spirituality, as a kind of my guiding antenna.
And what happened? Did it end up...
I think it made a difference in the world. So, I've touched many lives, hopefully. So just with the work that I'm doing, and that's the goal and my calling as well. And following that love and that calling, I mean, it's more calming and, I mean, healing, experience.
And can you imagine, had you not leaned into the anxiety, had you buttoned it up and avoided it and said, you know what? No one's ever going to accept me. My husband's never going to accept me and never spoken about the NDE. Where would you be today?
Yeah. It's hard to imagine, but
it's impossible to imagine right?
Yeah, it is impossible. It's hard to imagine what kind of a person I was. Definitely very unhappy. And there was a period that I was ignoring it, actually.
Of course. You said a couple of weeks.
Yeah, hoping that I'm forgetting it. And, you know, that this was just a dream and it's passing by. But it just keep knocking on my soul and consciousness. This is real. So there is a calling behind this. And that's where I am now and what I'm doing and why I'm doing, you know, what I'm doing. And I think that's the calling of the soul purpose, that we all are looking for it as a human being. So what is our purpose in this world? Either if we die or don't die. So
it's such a blessing that you've given to the world and to your family and to yourself by embracing that.
Thank you.
Many people don't embrace that anxiety. They run away from it. They medicate it away. They don't want to feel it at all. It's too scary. It's too afraid. It's too daunting. And they bury their dreams. They bury their relationships, and they actually end up in some ways burying themselves and their own identity.
Yeah,
and embracing
exactly.
And running towards our anxiety often is necessary. It's a necessary step in self-actualization, in becoming who we could be.
Yeah, it is. The anxiety has the information and the gift. I mean, and it's because of the ambiguity that it's the most discomfortable feeling comes from it. Because, I mean, the brain cannot stand the ambiguous situation. We want to know either way, this way or the other way. And I think the anxiety is telling you, you don't have enough information. So what you need more answers, and you have to go look for it or do something for it. And that's where the discomfort is coming from.
There is an alternative, which is accepting that anxiety is part of the package. It's just part of life, and we're never going to be able to get rid of all that uncertainty. Embracing it and learning to see what we have to do.
Yeah, what are the, I mean, after accepting part, what are the technique? You know, I do a lot of meditation. I do yoga meditation, we do Reiki, but meditation, not just basically meditation on the cushion. I just walking in the nature, listening to birds for me is a meditation, and anxiety relieving tool. What are the tools that you are offering in your practice?
Yeah, well, first of all, we need to embrace our anxiety and run towards it. Often people run away from their anxiety. We bury our head in the sand. We do everything we can to not talk about it, not think about it, squelch our feelings, remove ourselves from situations that make us feel anxious. And there's a cognitive behavior therapy technique called exposure therapy, where people can confront that which makes them feel anxious. It's not pleasant, but it kind of like going to the gym. It does build us and make us more emotionally resilient, just like lifting weights makes us more physically resilient.
Yeah, I'm practicing that with my podcast, you know. I'm kind of person also have like a stage anxiety, but I'm just doing the podcast as a practice and exposing myself to all the triggers to desensitize.
All right. Yeah. I'm glad to be part of that. That's fantastic.
Yeah, thank you so much, Dr. Rosmarin. So I know that people can reach you through the spirit.mclean.harvard.edu, but if you have any other resources and any other information as a last, you know, advice or note for our audience, please.
Absolutely. My author's website is drrosmarin.com. I love to hear from readers of the book, people who are interested in anxiety and many other things. And Center for Anxiety's website is centerforanxiety.org, and open for referrals in Massachusetts, New York, New Jersey, and other states as well.
That's wonderful. And as we discussed before the interview, I got a rain check from you that we will have you soon in the Institute of Coaching, you know, Spirituality in Coaching and Leadership Huddle, and that I'm leading, you know, one of the Wednesday of this year. So thank you so much for your contribution, Dr. Rosmarin.
That'd be my honor to contribute. Thank you so much.
Have a wonderful day.
You too. You take care.
Goodbye to our listeners, and remember, one podcast at a time. Thank you for being with us for another one. You can visit our website at myconscious.org to learn more about us, or write to us at coach@myconscious.org. And please stay connected by following us on our social media platforms, LinkedIn, Instagram, Facebook, or Twitter, not to miss our upcoming episodes and events. Love and light from all of us to you. Make it a great day, everyone.